This is Hamilton's Alternative, 101.5, The Hawk FM.
Good evening and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule, and tonight my guest is Ken Coit. Ken Coit is the manager of placemaking, public art, and projects for the City of Hamilton Tourism and Culture Division. He's a licensed architect and a former chair of the Hamilton and Burlington Society of Architects. Ken worked in private architectural practice for 10 years before joining the City of Hamilton Planning Department as an urban designer in 2004. In his city role and as a volunteer, Ken has undertaken numerous community building projects, including charrettes, exhibitions, and most recently, the Pier 8 Promenade Park Design Competition. Since taking a lead role in Hamilton's public art program in 2010, he has commissioned and installed over 20 public art projects across the city. Welcome to Art Waves, Ken Coit.
Thank you, Bernadette. Thanks for having me. And thank you for the show. I've learned a lot about the artists in town from your work, and I've heard very good things about it.
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to hear that. Okay, so no doubt the coronavirus pandemic has changed your professional life, I mean, as it has most of our lives. Can you tell us a little about that? Did everything stop for you this past March? And now that it's fall of 2020, has anything geared up again?
Well, surprisingly, at the beginning, of course, there was all sorts of shock and awe, changing, closing city offices. How do we communicate with staff? But surprisingly, we got quite good at it. We were on Zoom meetings very early. We've been able to continue with our public art consultation and public art projects. We've been able to have one continue, and we've been able to launch a new one during the COVID time. And my work, I also chair the Burlington Urban Design Review Committee, and we were able to move that successfully onto Zoom. I must admit, as a people person, I'm not a huge fan of constantly being in the virtual world. And of course, we're all working at home, which makes it hard for those kind of artistic, innovative conversations to be happening. And I tend to miss that a lot at the office. But beyond that, surprisingly, we've been able to adjust quite well. The city as a place, you know, people often think of it as pretty plodding and bureaucratic, but there's a lot of people there that really are quite fast on their feet when it comes to change to get things going and make things, keep things moving along. So surprisingly, we're doing quite well.
Well, it's not really a surprise. I mean, you know, people have to be pretty sharp to get a job in government and with the city, and especially when you're combining the role of artist and government. I think you're probably ahead of the game for most of us. Okay, so you are an urban designer, a city planner. Is that the same thing?
No. At least in my mind, no. And I think some of those people would be mad at me if I even called myself that to a certain degree, because I'm a licensed architect. I don't have my planning certification, although I've worked with a lot of planners and a lot of planning documents. And urban designer is this kind of quasi-position in between planning and architecture, I've always thought. So it's actually about the city and how buildings relate to public space. Whereas planning is often about zoning and private property and the rules of the OMB or whatever the new name for it is now. Sorry, it slips my mind. It's a much more abstract and legal kind of way of looking at the city. And urban design is more about what the city feels like, how buildings interact, how people use the city, and how streets and buildings and transportation and planting and all that works together to make interesting spaces and meaningful spaces.
Okay, so Jane, what was her name? Jane, who was very famous for...
Jane Jacobs?
Jane Jacobs, yeah. So she was an urban designer.
No, she's more of an urban theorist. I don't think she actually did a lot of the... She wouldn't have actually physically designed spaces. She would have probably got mad at some of the urban designers of the time for these kind of big Corbusian buildings with no front doors. She was actually somebody who was she would be an urbanist. She really loved cities for what they were and how people interacted and how people use space. And so she really influenced the last generation of urban designers and current generation of urban designers about how cities should feel and work and the mechanics of cities. And
okay. So can quite, let's not quite leave the pandemic yet. Do you see the pandemic having a fundamental huge effect on cities and city planning?
I think it has already. We've had this, at least from my point of view, in the short term, when you look at like King William Street in downtown Hamilton, for example, we've been talking about closing streets or having flexible streets to be able to use for public space for a long time. And, my friend Mary Poschus was at the vanguard of this in the 90s, trying to get streets closed for the Mustard Festival. And it took a lot of work, and the culture changed with Supercrawl to allow that to happen, but still it was a lot of work. And so with the pandemic requiring us to be outside, I think it's really helped move that agenda along with people who typically wouldn't have thought that way. We're often, we have this debate in urban design in our cities, what's a road and what's a street? I'm an urban designer, so I think the street is a place. So it's an address for buildings. It's a place where people interact. It's not just a place to move things and move cars and do deliveries. That's important too, but it's not just a road. So I think the pandemic's allowed us to move out onto the public realm and be a lot more flexible. And hopefully in the long term, that'll have a better impact for the quality of our cities. That being said, the idea that we have to be inside all the time and we have to all be 6 feet apart and wear masks, it's probably not the best for public space in the long term, or for density and the kind of density for cities that we need to fight climate change and make dynamic urban spaces. So that's a bit of a problem. The other good thing that I've seen come out of it is people biking and the cycling. You're changing the scale of the city to be more walkable and cyclable. Mm-hmm. There's some good things coming out of it too.
Yeah, I can feel that happening myself already, and I just hope that it lasts. I hope these changes last a little bit. I mean, I really do feel the skies are clearer, the clouds are more beautiful. We're more beautiful this summer somehow. I don't know, and there are more creatures. I've certainly seen more creatures around, than I had before. So it is interesting, and a huge variety of birds. And I've always been looking for that, but I saw it this year. Amazing. So, let's hope that does work for our good ecologically. Okay, so before we get to some of the projects that you've done for the city of Hamilton, can you tell us a little about some of the things you designed in your private practice? Did you always concentrate on public buildings or did you design private homes?
Well, I had a long stint for two local architects before I joined the city, John Harkness and then McCallum Sather Architects. And for them, I mostly worked on institutional buildings, schools, car dealerships as well. I was surprised driving around and realized how many car dealerships I actually worked on with John Harkness years ago. Cathedral High School is probably one of the biggest buildings I worked on when I was very young as just an intern working for John Harkness.
Well, that is a great school.
Yeah. And later in my career, I started doing a lot more heritage stuff with McCallum Sather. So they're a really great local firm, and I worked for them for about 10 years as an associate. They did the Workers' Arts and Heritage Center renovation. I work with them on Alumni Memorial Hall at McMaster. And so I very much got interested in the heritage of the city later. I have done a few private houses, and I do like doing houses. I like connecting with clients. Probably one of my favorites is 111 Mountain Park Drive on the mountain that I did for an artist friend of mine and her husband just after I joined the city and I started winding down doing architecture.
And was this building it from scratch or doing
it? Oh, yeah. No, it was a built from scratch.
Oh, I'll have to drive past 111 Mountain Park Drive. That sounds like fun. So then you made the move gradually into working for the city in terms of their public art and all. But before we talk about that still, when did you become interested in architecture? Can you take us back to your earliest memories of noticing buildings particularly or trying to sketch things out?
Oh, I always drew as a kid. I always remember drawing things, planning things. I was always interested in the history of places and geography and travel. I really wasn't sure I was going to be an architect until I was in second or third year architecture school. Getting in is quite the, can be quite the challenge. You have to do all these interviews and present a portfolio. And I didn't have great marks either. So, and one of the questions was always, well, how do you know you want to be an architect? And I remember I had a little bit of, I think I was cranky that day. And I think I just said to the interview panel, well, I'm not sure what an architect is yet. I'm coming here for you to teach me that. So I'll be able to answer that question this time next year.
Oh, brat.
Yeah. And I think that's how I got in, but I'm not quite sure. Because I didn't have great marks. And yeah, but they let 60 of us in. And so once I'd been there for a year or two, I kind of figured out, yeah, this is my gig. I like doing this stuff.
Where did you go to school?
University of Waterloo.
Oh, yeah. Well, their architecture center is very, very big news. That's great. Were you there when they built their architecture center on the river?
The one in Cambridge? No. I was the little orange brick building that's on the main campus. So, yeah, I graduated probably 5 or 6 years before they even started that project.
All right. So did you have particular teachers or mentors as you came along?
There's kind of two men. There's architecture mentors in my life. There's architects I've looked up to. Some of my professors, Val Rinamary, who taught urban design and in third year at U of W, was a great professor and a mentor to me, someone I look up to. Another one is Bridget Shim. Bridget Shim and Howard Sutcliffe have a wonderful body of work, beautiful little homes and just little jewel boxes of architecture. And she was a professor of mine in second year, and I learned a lot about architecture from her. But perhaps the people who taught me most about architecture were, and the city, which is what I got more interested in than just creating buildings, were citizens. Probably one of the people that inspired me most was Mary Poschus, who used to run the International Village BIA. And when I came back to Hamilton after architecture school, downtown Hamilton was in pretty sorry shape.
Yes.
And she was one of the people that was trying to make it better. And she used to sit through council meetings. I just remember learning from her about the challenges that small business was having and how the city worked and, you know, how taxes worked and how zoning rules worked and how all these things can either help a city move forward or they can really be in the way. And the different social prejudices that come with different parts of the city and what that means for a place in the city. And she just had a chutzpah and a way of getting out there and just talking about ideas straightforwardly. Very Hamilton kind of character, salt of the earth. And and she just got stuff done. And I learned a lot about what she thought about architectures and city making was very helpful to inform me about how to move forward in my career and what architecture can and can't do and what community means and what community can and can't do and what city hall and zoning can and can't do.
Well, that's fabulous. I like the way you're explaining it. Your passion came through buildings, basically, and then you learned more and more, and you learned as you went. You didn't come into any of it knowing a lot about it, and this is, of course, true for everybody, but we don't think of it that way. We don't like to admit it that way, you know, so this is very refreshing. I'm enjoying this, Ken Coit, and if you've just tuned in, let me just remind you, listeners, that this is Art Waves on 101.5 The Hawk. I'm Bernadette Rule, and my guest tonight is Manager of Placemaking, Public Art, and Projects for the City of Hamilton Tourism and Culture Division, Ken Coit. Okay, now you've talked about people who have influenced you, teachers, and so on. Favorite architects that you have not mentioned already, or favorite artists of other kinds that you feel have inspired you?
I have to be careful. I used to be such a fan of some of the Starkitects, as they're called. You know, people like Daniel Libeskind and Rem Koolhaas and Frank Gehry, Diller and Scofolio, people that I looked up to in school. But as I've moved forward, there's other types of architects that are more community-based and that are more about the vernacular, so looking at what's actually happening. people like Christopher Alexander, who's written, it's a, quite an old book now, I think, because I think I'm old now, as I come to realize I graduated 30 years ago now. It's called The Pattern Language, which was kind of looking at the way people used and built small towns and the vernacular. And I found that very refreshing, the idea that there's a kind of small is beautiful, there's a way people live in the city. That's always been a kind of undercurrent in how I've looked at buildings. At the same time, I've always admired Frank Gehry for his ability to just be such a shapeshifter and working with artists and doing very unexpected things. As an architect who had to learn how to detail roofs so they didn't leak and make sure piping worked and that bricks lined up right, I look at his building sometimes and go, wow, like, how did you build that? And go, I would never want to own that because I'm sure the roof is going to leak sooner or later. But I find his stuff quite amazing and his attitude so refreshing. Still, I think I was listening to him on CBC last week and he's 90-something now. So he was, of all the architects, he's probably the one I look up to the most. In terms of artists, I have to be really careful because I work with so many now, and I've learned to like them for their approach and not just, you know, the objects they necessarily create. So there's all sorts of local artists. I just, you know, Petra Mitar, a young architect as well. Dave Hind, all the group from TH&B. I loved working with Laura Murata in Hamilton. She won a public art call. So, a lot of local artists.
Yeah. Well, don't worry. We won't make you keep on this tack if it's uncomfortable. But yeah, it's true that there's a lot of talent in the Hamilton area right now, and it is exciting to see what people are doing. Okay, so Ken Coy, did you design your own home? Can you describe where you live and what kinds of things are terribly important to you in your own living space?
Oh, I'm a bit of a, you know, the shoemaker doesn't take care of his own shoes kind of person. So I live in the 1960s side split that is really not what my architecture friends would call an architectural wonder. It's a pretty standard house. What makes it great is it's in a great neighborhood. It's walkable to things. The people around are great, close to Lock Street. But architecturally, you know, it will be a challenge. I often look at it and think it's not a typical architect's house in any way, shape, or form. But the interesting thing will be, as we've lived in it now, my partner and I have lived here about 20 years. So it'll be, how do you start to refresh it and change it? And that's always something I found interesting about the city too, and buildings, how buildings learn over time. It's not necessarily, you know, you build your great palace right at the beginning or this really funky building. It's how does it work and how does it change over time and what happens to it? Because some buildings, I was lucky enough to do a study term in Rome, Italy, when I went to Waterloo. Ooh. And you look at buildings there that are hundreds of years old and you see how they've been renovated and what's changed and what's stayed. So I think the interesting thing for me is once I come up from air from work and get maybe more into retirement mode and start looking at this house again, it'll be, how do we change this? What is this house going to be? What do you do with the 1966 side split in 2021? How do you make it eco-relevant? How do people use it? Because it's an interesting house. It's a house designed for a family, right? It's got the side split. It's got a garage internal, and I'm not a car person. I walk to work if I can. So how do you start to change the house? You know, what parts of it don't you use? What parts do you use? It'll be an interesting exercise.
Well, I've heard people say that renovation is much harder than building from scratch. And I can imagine that that is the case.
It can be. It depends. It's like I've always, when you look at James Street North and the success of places like Mulberry Coffee House and some of the other buildings downtown, they've kind of done an architecture of subtraction where you just accept the building kind of for what it is and just take away some of the stuff that doesn't make sense until you get a really great and interesting kind of project that just comes out of the building. Right. And if you do renovation like that, it can be quite easy and quite interesting. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to change the building into something completely new or different, that's when it can get really difficult.
And of course, you have to be someone who's trained to understand about load-bearing walls and things like that before you jump in and start removing a whole lot of stuff. It is as well to have someone like you around, I'm sure. And again, here it is again, this theory of yours of or this approach of yours that you learn as you go. You're saying the same thing about houses, buildings learn over time. I really like this concept that we just have to keep getting better and better, and it becomes, we become smarter with time. So Ken Coit, you say in your bio that you have commissioned and installed over 20 public art projects across Hamilton. Can you tell us about some of the things that you've done?
Well, I have to be careful because they're not mine. They're the artists. I see myself as a kind of enabler to set the stage for artists to come up with great ideas and then help them implement them, select them and implement them. So there's the piece in front of the market, Raise the Barn, by David Hind and the Aluminum Quilting Society. Another piece is Eagles Among Us by David M. General, an Indigenous artist. That's about peace and reconciliation, and that piece is down in Battlefield Park. Some of the funnest ones we've done. Last summer, I have a young staff person, Zara Wang, and we worked together to wrap all the traffic boxes in downtown with art. And it's a great project because you can reach out to people who aren't typical public artists, because they can just be anybody who can, who's an artist, who has a design vision, can do it on the computer or can take pictures of their art. And then it gets formatted to go on these boxes. So we have 30 of them around downtown, and they're really quite lovely to see all those different kind of ways people look at the world and people think about downtown Hamilton.
So, sorry, you literally got individuals. Sarah Wang didn't do it herself. No,
she didn't. What we do is we do a call for artists. That's how we kind of set the stage for the art. We work with the community to develop a theme. In this case, it was stuff celebrating downtown Hamilton.
Yeah.
And then we put a call out for artists and saying, okay, this is the, these are the size of the boxes. This is the size of imagery we need. Send us your stuff. And we have a jury of citizens and artists that select. And we usually shortlist some, and we'll give them a little bit more money to tart up their designs and make their designs a little better for the public to be able to see. And then we put them out for public consultation. And then public provide comments, and it comes back to the jury. And then based on that, the jury selects the winner. In this case, because they were boxes, we were selecting, instead of just one winner, I think we were selecting about 35. And we got 100 and some odd submissions. So we got a great variety.
That's really nice, too, to be able to use so many of the ideas and not just have to choose one. That's the problem with these contests, I think, is that it's the hard part. Everybody's a loser except one person, usually. Yeah, that's great. Now, when you do something like the public art on the traffic boxes, is that thought of as a permanent thing, or will it change, you know, when you start?
Oh, yeah. No, we know when we start. We know how long they'll last. The bigger public art pieces, like the one in front of the market or the one down on the waterfront, Rafaegla Unleashed, they're meant to last a long time, and we have maintenance budgets to take care of them. And when we pick them, part of the criteria is the materiality of them. You know, are they graffiti resistant? Are they going to rust? How do we, you know, will they last? But the boxes are temporary. So the wraps are meant to last. Now, the digital files will last as long as we can keep the computers going and they don't make whatever obsolete. But the idea is they'll last outside for, you know, probably 3 to 5 years before they start to fade, depending on where they are and what the technology is. And then they'll just have to be stripped off, and we can either do new ones or do other things. So we call that temporary art.
All right. And it occurs to me, I was just thinking about this morning as I was driving down James Street South toward St. Joe's Hospital. And I saw that big mural sort of under the, just past the overpass there, the overbridge or whatever you call it. And I was looking at that and thinking, Now, that has to have been something that the city installed because it has a kind of sheen to it that looks like it would be washable. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that project's called Gateway, and it was selected through a public art competition 2 years ago now. And yeah, it's a digital piece, so the artist did it on the computer, and then we printed it on panels, and the panels have a graffiti-resistant coating. And again, it's a temporary piece. It'll probably last 10 years.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember there was a mural there before that I quite liked as well. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about graffiti. I had Eclipse Robinson on the show.
Yeah.
He's just an absolute ball of fire and a marvelous guy, a very creative force. So have you worked with him at all?
Yes. He and Scott McDonald, we spent a lot of time last summer working. I tried to help them, and they did the work for a project called Concrete Canvas to start to bring street art onto buildings. And they did a great job. They brought artists from all over the place. We helped with a bit of sponsorship money. We worked with the city's graffiti strategy people to be clear about, you know, graffiti is tagging and unwanted things on buildings and public spaces, whereas street art is you have the permission and it's actually art. It's not a tag. It's actually a piece of art. And we also worked with them to develop a legal wall project down at Barton and Wentworth
in
Woodlands Park. So we pulled them together with...
Sorry, Ken, in what park?
In Woodland Park at Barton and Wentworth.
Yeah.
And we worked with them and with parks, and we set up a wall along the north side of the park, and they helped us set up rules and promote it, and it's a street art wall. So any up-and-coming artist, I think Scott McDonald, who was part of this project and is friends with Leon with Eclipse, he's done several pieces to help launch it. And so that launched about a year ago now, actually, about a year from today it launched. And it's been very successful. So a lot of the younger street artists down there try their stuff on that. And every couple of months, people paint over each other or the city will paint it over. So it's trying to develop a responsible street art culture where people are actually seeing this as art, not as graffiti.
And where they can get credit for it and so forth. Yeah, that's wonderful. He was fascinating to talk to, and I'm madly trying to think of the other mural artist that I had on who has murals all down around Walnut and on James Street North and so on.
Lester Coloma.
Yeah,
he's done a lot of murals. The city actually has a program that we started about 10 years ago. It started in the downtown where we'll match money for facade improvements. And the mural, Lester has taken advantage of that and done a number of beautiful murals.
Yes, he's very, very talented too.
Yeah, working with, and he's more on the street art. He's less on the graffiti side and more on the street art muralist side. But his work is very stunning.
Yeah. What are some other things that you've worked on in your years with the city?
Well, I worked on the LRT for a while as an urban designer years ago before its current version. As I said in the bio, I was very lucky to be allowed to work with the waterfront people to run a design competition for the new park down on Copps Pier. That's the first time we've done a design competition for a major piece of infrastructure since the 1930s. So it was wonderful to work on that and involve the public in that. We kind of followed our public art call for artists process to do that. Doing an open competition, kind of setting a budget and criteria for the park and the site, and then letting I think we pre-qualified 6 or 8 groups, and they came up with designs, and then we evaluated the designs with a jury. Very similar to the public art. We had the public make comments on them before a winner was selected. So hopefully that will turn into a really iconic place in the city.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And then you also mentioned in your bio charrettes. Can you explain what they are?
Oh, yeah, this is so it's an architect's thing. I don't know, maybe a bit snobby, I'm not quite sure, but I always learned of it as something that came from the École des Beaux-Arts, which was the architecture school in Paris in the early 1900s, late 1800s. And I guess charrette means little cart in French. And so the idea of a charrette is you have a big problem, a big complicated problem, and you have a very limited amount of time to do it. So the professor would set out, design this big building, and you've got one day or 2 days, and you have to do these drawings. And so you'd get all the drawings done, and the cart, the little charrette, the cart would come around and collect them at the deadline. So it's all about the deadline culture. And in planning and architecture, what we often use it to do, the one that I was most involved with, I've done about four or five now, but the one that was most kind of important to me was the Downtown Ideas Charrette we did in 1996. And that's when we pulled up planners, bankers, architects. Mary Poschus, that I talked about earlier, was a big part of that. About, okay, how do we solve downtown Hamilton? What do we do to make downtown Hamilton better? And we had a day of just crazy group thinking, and they came up with all sorts of ideas and all sorts of issues about the city that ended up being quite important. Things like creating the Downtown Renewal Division, getting rid of one-way streets came out of that. There was councillors involved in it as well, in this kind of charrette thing, and a lot of local businesses put up money to make it work. We did it at the Wright House. It was a great event, and it proved to me how important community is, and that people really care about places and want to make places better, which I think is a real important part of Hamilton's culture. It's something I see here that I haven't always seen in other places I've lived in my life. And it can really make a change. It really changes the way people think about things.
Definitely. Ken Coit, were you born in Hamilton?
Yeah, West Mountain.
Okay, but you've lived around other places as well before.
Yeah, the luck for me in that was architecture school was co-op. So I paid my own way through, but I was lucky enough that we had these jobs in between. So I worked in Vancouver, in Montreal, in Toronto, tried to work in England for a while. And as I said, we did a study term in Rome. So I was able to see a lot of the world when I was in architecture school. And we had friends from school that are all over, Los Angeles, Boston, Europe, Japan, Hong Kong, because we did these co-op terms all over the world. So it was quite a wonderful experience.
Wonderful indeed. It sounds just, oh my gosh, I'm so jealous. So, Ken Coit, you've kind of answered this in a way, but I want you to answer it very directly. How do you feel art impacts the life of a city?
Well, it kind of helps move the city's culture along. It helps. It's one of the best ways to define our collective culture and tell our collective story. And it makes these unique landmarks. Architecturally, we live in a time that everything is very similar and conventioned and compartmentalized and standardized. Like if you drive across North Toronto, it gets pretty hard telling, North York from Markham, from, the buildings, they're all tall condo towers. They all, all the malls look fairly similar. They all have the same stores. So the idea that I kind of see art as a little bit of a pollution and critique of that, if you know what I mean. And it provides that extra level of interest, the you are here, the we are about this, or what's that about? That's interesting. It's the thing that can make you think where sometimes our urban design and architecture fails us.
Nicely put. What are you most proud of so far in your role as manager of placemaking public art and projects for the city of Hamilton? Something you've already mentioned?
Well, I like to think that we're trying to build a culture and a group of people that are going to start accepting artists into being important placemakers, important playing important roles in what our new buildings look like, what our streets look like, and helping to build a culture at City Hall that allows that to happen and wants that to happen, and in the community in general, that becomes an expectation that artists make an important contribution.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that citizens are part of that discussion.
Exactly.
That's kind of it. And to a certain degree, I think we've been successful to a certain degree with that. Maybe not totally. We'll see what COVID does to that. But yeah. We're going to keep trying.
Well, COVID is certainly putting its mark on all sorts of things, for sure. Okay, so what are some of your goals and dreams for the future, Ken Coit? You talked a little bit about retirement there, but I don't know how close you are to that. But
I don't think we're allowed to talk about that yet officially. I don't know. There's so many. Again, I think my goal is to just keep working and building on what I'm doing now, whether that be at the city or be in another role. As back in an architecture urban design practice. But I'm very happy in Hamilton, and the idea of community and being part of the larger community and making a contribution. As long as I'm making a contribution, I'm happy.
Yeah, and when you were a child growing up here, would you ever have imagined getting this creamy, wonderful job?
No. Or living where I live, or any of those kind of things. So, yeah, I've come a long way from where I started. I grew up in a townhouse at the corner of Garth and Stone Church.
Oh, yeah. Well, that area has really blossomed with townhouses since as well. It's crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, when I lived there, the drive-in was still there. I remember cars lining up for the drive-in. And we're right at the edge of the city at that point. So,
So there was a drive-in in the west end of the city?
Because yeah.
there's still a drive-in in the east end.
No, the Hamilton drive-in was on Stone Church Road, just west of Garth and east of Upper Paradise.
Okay. And it's interesting how the drive-ins are coming back with the COVID, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, but there is one that in the area, because my kids have gone to it. It was on the East Mountain somewhere.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Starlight Earth, I think, is still here, yeah.
Something like that.
Upper Stony Creek Mountain.
Yeah. So Stony Creek was sort of where the country opened up at one time. Well, now you just can drive for miles and still be in housing developments. It's crazy. Okay. Do you have any advice for people? You talk about learning as you go. You talk about coming a long way in your own life and where you have gotten to and the glory, the wonder of that, the delight of that, having some kind of power, some kind of say in what things are going to look like. Do you have any advice for young people who are listening to this and just thinking, oh, wow, I want to do that too?
Learn how to listen to people. Learn to like people. There's a power in working together with people. And there's always a surprise about, you can always learn something from somebody else. Even people that you think you don't like or you're very different from, sometimes those are the best people to have really meaningful conversations with. That's what I've learned the most about how you live in a city and respecting people and community, is actually taking the time to really listen to what people are saying. And especially in a position like mine where I'm, you know, making decisions about public funds and public money, I think it's really important to be listening as much as you can and empowering those people to have a say and truly understanding what their issues are and what their concerns are.
Okay. It just sounds wonderful. It sounds like your life is all wrapped up and all aiming in the same direction with great integrity and unity and so forth. What do you do that's the furthest away from art and architecture and the things that you're so passionate about?
Probably go to the gym.
Oh, well, that's pretty far away.
Gym culture. I need to go to the gym to work out my stress and make sure that, you know, I'm the first generation of architects who started drawing on the computer. And so I've spent thousands of hours hunched over a computer. So I need to go to the gym to make sure, like, I can still stand up straight and my arms still work and all that. And I just need to, and now it's become, I started doing it for my health and now it's become a bit of an addiction. So yeah, I have this weird gym culture where I have my workout clothes and go do all that stuff, which is, certainly at odds with kind of the art culture.
Yeah.
That's the kind of joy of Hamilton. It's small enough that all these kind of cultures intertwine and you find people in places you wouldn't expect.
It's really true. Hamilton is an amazing place that way, for sure. And, you know, I have heard it said before that that if you make yourself get into the gym thing, that it becomes an addiction. I just have never gotten there yet, but maybe someday. And, you know, things are worse than ever in terms of hunching over a computer because we're doing so much online with COVID.
Yeah, exactly. And you're at home, so you don't have all the special right equipment, right? You find yourself curled up on the couch looking at your computer for 3 hours and then get up and realize, I can't move.
So true. Oh, well, what a delight to talk to you. I'm down to my final question now, unless you have anything else you wanted to throw out there. Is there anything you want to encourage people to get out and see that's happening soon? Or
no, not right now. I was going to say, you just, if you want to learn more about the city's public art, go to hamilton.ca, www.hamilton.ca/public art. And you can see our projects there. And there you can also find a map that lists all the projects all over the city, where they are, and the artist's name, and all the artist's description for each one. So you can see a little bit of a tour of all the art that the city owns, all the public art that the city owns. So that's a great resource.
That's fabulous. Okay, I'm glad you mentioned that. All right, Ken, quite finally, what piece of music have you chosen for us to close Art Waves with tonight, and why did you choose that one?
I am a bit of a jazz aficionado because my mother was a jazz person when I was young. I listened to lots of jazz.
Yeah.
Didn't know what it was when I was 12, 13, and 14, but it stuck in my brain. So I'm a huge fan of Oscar Peterson, and one of my favorites is Hymn to Freedom by the Oscar Peterson Trio.
Oh, I'm so glad you chose that one. I love that one too. And how very appropriate in the times we're living through right now with Black Lives Matter and all of that. It's very important to remember him and his music. Thank you so much, Ken Coit, for being my guest tonight on Art Waves. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. All right, and we always thank our listeners for tuning in as well. I know you really enjoyed this conversation tonight, and I hope you can join me next week at 101.5 The Hawk, 7 o'clock on Sunday night, for another edition of Art Waves, where we'll have another conversation with another amazing Hamilton artist. And until then, this is Bernadette Rule wishing you a good night on the shores of Lake Ontario.
listening to CIOI, The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
This is 101.5 FM, The Hawk, and welcome to Max's Video Game Collection. Today we are going to be listening to some of the music from Ukulele by Grant Kirkhope, David Wise, and Steve Burke. It's a nice looking day. Let's sit outside and read our magic book in main theme. Reading the magic book out here in main theme was a good idea, but I'm getting tired, so I'm just gonna put the book over here. That bee guy has a book that looks just like ours, but ours is over there. It's gone! He must have stolen it! Let's get it back from him. He can't get far in Shipwreck Creek. The bee guy is gone. He must have gotten out of Shipwreck Creek somehow. This is The Hawk, 101.5 FM, and you are listening to Max's Video Game Collection, where we are listening to some of the music from Ukulele by Grant Kirkhope, David Wise, and Steve Burke. That bee guy must have gone in Ivory Towers. in Ivory Towers that B Guy said his name was capital B and that he'll never give us our book back. While we explore, we find a book that looks just like ours, but it tells of a place called Tribal Stack Tropics. Let's jump into World 1, Variant 1. Pagey in World 1 Variant 1 told us to get our book back, we have to collect all the other Pageys and fight capital B. This is The Hawk, 101.5 FM, and you are listening to Max's Video Game Collection, where we are listening to some of the music from Ukulele by Grant Kirkhope, David Wise, and Steve Burke. This guy Cardo says he can help us get a Pagey in Minecart Theme World 1.